From NPR and Futuro Media, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, President Trump says he wants to get rid of birthright citizenship. So can he?
There is a provision in the 14th Amendment that makes an exception for people who are said to be not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States.
And we look at what happened to a country that actually did take birthright citizenship away. In the Dominican Republic, a controversial court decision in 2013 revoked citizenship from the children of immigrants. Plus, you might have seen him on HBO's Looking or on Netflix's 7 Seconds. We have a conversation with actor Raul Castillo.
In New York City, I was like a kid from McAllen, Texas, and here I am. And everyone was acting like it was the most natural thing. And I went into the bathroom and I cried.
All this coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Exactly 1 week before the midterm election, President Trump announced on the political show Axios on HBO that he plans to end birthright citizenship in the United States.
Have you talked about that with counsel?
Yeah, I have.
So where in the process?
It's in the process. It'll happen.
This is an idea he first proposed back when he was campaigning for president in 2015, that children born in the U.S. whose parents are not citizens should not be given U.S. citizenship.
Number one, the 14th Amendment is very questionable as to whether or not somebody can come over, have a baby, and immediately that baby is a citizen, okay?
The court has pretty much said that it reads in immigrants there. This is a minority legal opinion you're talking about.
We wanted to separate fact from fiction around what could actually happen with birthright citizenship in the United States. So we brought in a historian to help us set the record straight about what our Constitution says about the rights we are born with and what it has meant historically to be a citizen of the United States. And later, to contextualize this conversation about citizenship, we'll bring back a story we did earlier this year about a place that did, in fact, revoke birthright citizenship. And we look at what the consequences of that change were. But first off, Latino USA producer Fernanda Chavarri speaks with history professor Martha S. Jones from Johns Hopkins University. Jones is the author of Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. Here's Fernanda.
Did you ever think you'd be answering questions about the nuances and legality of birthright citizenship in 2018?
I have to say, I did anticipate that I might be answering these questions because I'm a student of history. And what I know from history is that citizenship, including birthright, has been the subject of longstanding and recurring debate in this country going back to the early decades of the 19th century. So in some ways, this is an old question that's taken a new form in 2018.
So before we even talk about what the president is proposing right now, I want to go back in history. As we know, the 14th Amendment guarantees birthright citizenship. So can you give us a brief history of the 14th Amendment, when it was created, and why?
The 14th Amendment is ratified, becomes part of the Constitution in 1868. This is the period after the American Civil War. This is the period following the abolition of slavery. And one of the questions on the table for the nation is, who will former slaves be before the Constitution now that they are free persons? And the 14th Amendment is an effort, an important effort, to answer that question by designating, deeming all former slaves, more than 4 million people, citizens by virtue of birthright, for the first time incorporating Black Americans into the body politic.
It was written to give free slaves citizenship, but it extended, I assume, to anybody who was migrating from Europe at the time as well, anybody who was having children here, correct?
Yeah, there is an important in-migration during the years that precede the 14th Amendment of, for example, German and Irish immigrants to the United States by the tens of thousands. And there never is, how can I say, there never is a live question about the citizenship status of those children. They are assumed, in part because they are white, that the 14th Amendment does indeed guarantee to their children as well birthright citizenship, yes.
And has this ever been challenged?
Sure. Birthright is challenged in the wake of its ratification in 1868 by the example and the lives of Chinese immigrants and their children. This challenge to the status of the children of Chinese immigrants will go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court at the end of the 19th century in a case brought by a man named Wong Kim Ark. Wong Kim Ark was the child of Chinese immigrants to the United States. He traveled out of the U.S. to China as an adult. And when he returned to the port of San Francisco, when he returned home, he was detained. And customs officials asserted that Wong Kim Ark, because his parents were not citizens of the United States, that he too was not a citizen. And it was necessary for him to take that question all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And when he does, the court affirms that even though Wong Kim Ark's parents were not citizens, this did not have an effect on the status of Wong Kim Ark himself, who, by virtue of his birthright in San Francisco, was a citizen of the United States.
If we fast forward from the late 1800s to now, do you think that if we were using the same example today, that it would go all the way to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court would rule in the same way that it did?
We're in a moment during which there are varying and competing interpretations of the 14th Amendment. There is a provision in the 14th Amendment that makes an exception for people who are said to be not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Those people, even as they are born here, are not citizens of the U.S. by virtue of birthright. What does that mean in the 21st century? Well, that's the question that is on the table in this very moment.
And this specific phrase, this is the line in the 14th Amendment that says, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. So the question is those few words, the jurisdiction thereof.
When Congress drafts the 14th Amendment, I can tell you what they have in mind. They have in mind the children of foreign diplomats who might be incidentally born in the United States. Those children are not entitled to birthright citizenship. They have in mind children born to soldiers of an occupying army. It's a hypothetical, but in Congress's mind, those children also would not be citizens of the United States. Finally, Congress is thinking about Native Americans who in the 1860s, many of whom live in their own sovereign, independent Native nations, and those people are also not made citizens by virtue of birthright. So it's to say that Congress, as it drafts the 14th Amendment, is not thinking about what today we might term the circumstances of unauthorized immigrants to the United States. That is not the question that troubles or concerns Congress in 1868, but there are those, including the president, who are splitting hairs in 2018 and would draw a distinction between children born to authorized immigrants and children born to unauthorized immigrants.
President Trump has mentioned the possibility of changing the Constitution and ending birthright citizenship in a way by the stroke of his pen with an executive order. Is that something that he can legally do?
Can the president legally issue an executive order that interprets the 14th Amendment and directs federal agencies Yes, he can. He will be, of course, then challenged immediately. And when he is challenged, his action will be subject to the review of the federal court. In our legal culture, it is the U.S. Supreme Court that has the last or the final say about how to interpret any provision in the Constitution, including this birthright citizenship provision in the 14th Amendment.
And Trump also said that the U.S. is the only country in the world where a person can have a baby, and because that baby is born here, that the baby is automatically a U.S. citizen.
We're the only country in the world where a person comes in, has a baby, and the baby is essentially a citizen of the United States.
And we know that that's simply not true.
The president is wrong to say that the United States alone grants birthright citizenship. Many countries around the world do, including Canada.
Birthright is actually the regime that is predominant in the Americas, for example.
If something were to happen, and if President Trump were to sign something today, what are we looking at in terms of time?
Well, I think it depends on how quickly the case would to make it through the courts. The travel ban is a good way to study the question, which is to say it takes many months, but I don't think it will be many, many years. If the travel ban example is a model, then we know the administration, once it commits to a position, will be very aggressive.
Let's say that the U.S. Supreme Court rules on this case and then there are changes to birthright citizenship. What would that look like? Would it be something that is done retroactively?
I think it's unlikely that what we will see is the retroactive stripping of citizenship for millions of Americans who were born of unauthorized immigrant parents. The law and the Constitution do not favor ex post facto laws, right? Laws that look backwards and transform conditions and status. It's because it invites a kind of chaos. So I think that is less likely.
It sounds like you're saying we need to look at this with context and understanding the history of what's happened in the past. People shouldn't panic because things aren't going to change in 24 hours, but there is a possibility that the Supreme Court at one point could interpret this differently. So there are changes to birthright citizenship, right?
It would be unfair to overly reassure anyone, especially people whose lives, whose families are on the front lines of these questions, to reassure people. So the historian in me knows that, unfortunately, as a nation, we are very capable, right, of mismanaging. That's a generous word, right? But really mismanaging and sidestepping and fumbling and leaving human beings in legal limbo for a very long time. That is what African Americans faced in the decades before the Civil War, was this kind of uncertainty that is burdening today immigrants in the United States. It's exactly what African Americans felt, you know, 150, 200 years ago.
Martha Jones, professor of history at Johns Hopkins University and author of the book Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Fernanda Chavarri is a producer at Latino USA. And coming up on Latino USA, the story of a country that actually did revoke birthright citizenship. Stay with us, no te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing justice and opportunity for people in need. More information at publicwelfare.org. And the Arcus Foundation, dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world. Learn more about Arcus and its partners at arcusfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And this week, to help us contextualize the current conversation about citizenship in the United States, we're bringing back a story of ours that we first aired earlier this year. And to tell this story, I'm joined by Marlon Bishop. Hey, Marlon.
Hey, Maria. The story we're going to tell today is about a place where what President Trump is proposing actually happened, a place that used to have birthright citizenship and now effectively doesn't. That place is the Dominican Republic.
And the Dominican Republic is, of course, a country in the Caribbean that shares an island with Haiti. It's one island, two countries.
Yes. And I think the Dominican story is helpful for understanding a little bit about our politics today in the U.S. around the topic of birthright citizenship. And to learn more about what happened, I spoke with someone who lived through it. His name is Antonio Charles. We meet in a university classroom after hours. Antonio unzips a backpack and takes out a thick tan folder.
I can show you. Yeah.
It's filled with important documents from Antonio's life.
This is my high school diploma. A lot of cools that I...
Those are all your diplomas. You take them everywhere you go.
A lot of diplomas.
The folder is packed. Diplomas, report cards, random certificates, notarized letters.
I have nothing, no visa, nothing.
Antonio takes this folder with him literally everywhere he goes. And there's a reason for that.
If migration took me, they won't accept my document like I'm legal here.
So you bring your documents so just in case they take you and send you away, you'll have it with you?
I don't know what could happen.
Antonio laughs, but it's a nervous laugh. He's worried. The thing is, Antonio isn't from Haiti. His parents are, but he's never even been there. He was born in the Dominican Republic. But now he could be forced to leave.
Anything could happen. If I have my document with me, maybe if I get anywhere, I could start a new life, maybe.
I first found out about Antonio through a friend who's a musician in the DR. Antonio is himself an aspiring musician. Before I met him, I checked out his YouTube channel. Most of the videos are of him playing American jazz standards, filmed against a green wall, holding a sunburst Fender guitar. He seems shy, never looking at the camera, always down at his fingers while he's playing. Antonio is shy, but personable. He's in his late 20s, a musician, and an evangelical Christian. Religion is a big part of his life. And in some ways, his story is typical of Dominicans of Haitian descent.
Familia es una típica familia trabajadora.
He told me his parents migrated to the DR from Haiti and were hired to work on a sugarcane plantation.
Un ingenio azucarero los contrató.
He was born in the DR and his parents left him with relatives in the capital from a really young age where they thought he'd have a better life.
Vivía con unos familiares.
And he told me that it was really hard for him to talk about his story.
There's a lot of things that happened. Maybe I wouldn't be able to talk with that without maybe crying or things like that. Because I dream and I fight so hard to have better opportunity in my life.
He told me that he felt that he was born in the wrong place because ever since he was little, he had this dream in his life to get an education.
Studying, getting in the society, no matter where my family came.
Antonio's family had very limited economic resources, but he was able to get on a scholarship to a private school, which helped cover some of the cost. But
I was living without my parents, and I have to work and to eat.
So he started working really young, before he was 12. He shined shoes, sold peanuts, collected scrap metal and sold that.
How much did you make a day?
Maybe 50 pesos.
50 pesos is like a dollar. And he told me that some days he would have a budget of 5 pesos for breakfast, and he had to decide if he was going to spend that money on an egg or bread. He knew the bread would make him feel fuller, but the egg had more nutrients.
if I buy one egg, I know there are a lot of vitamins. Even I don't feel I've been eating a lot. And when I get some money, what I did with it, eat a little and pay transportation or buy a book, maybe.
So a pretty determined kid.
Really determined. But there's more.
I don't have document.
Documents. Even though he was born in the DR, he didn't have any documentation. His parents never got a birth certificate for him or officially registered him with the government. He says they kind of just didn't know any better. And so when it was time for him to sign up for high school, he came up with this alternative solution.
I get it from my brother, really. That's what I did.
You used your brother's document.
That's what I did.
So he used that one to go to school. And while he was in high school, something happened that changed everything, not just for him, but for everybody like him, all Dominicans of Haitian descent all over the country, whether they had proper paperwork or not.
What happened?
The president here gave the order.
The order. What is he talking about?
So let's zoom out for a second. There's this really long and complicated history between the DR and Haiti. We can't get into all the details in this story, but one key thing to know is that in recent decades, Haitians have been immigrating in fairly large numbers to the Dominican Republic, mostly to do low-wage jobs like construction or domestic work. I spoke to a journalist named Jonathan Katz about this.
My name is Jonathan Katz. I was an Associated Press correspondent.
He worked at the Associated Press both in the DR and Haiti, and he wrote a New York Times Magazine piece about what's been going on there in recent years. And he explained to me it's a situation much like anywhere in the world.
Where you have people who are poor and they come in and they're doing jobs.
Jobs that people need to do, but then you get this dynamic.
You hear the same things about them that you would hear, you know, in parts of the United States about people from Mexico or Central America. Why are they coming here and taking our jobs? They're going to dilute some, you know, national aspect that we have that we don't want to let go of.
Because the children of those immigrants from Haiti, they become Dominicans, right? The same way you're American if you're born in the U.S.
The Dominican Constitution since 1865 has guaranteed, or did until very recently guarantee, that anybody born on Dominican soil was automatically a Dominican citizen. They had birthright citizenship the same way that we do in the United States.
So they did have their own version of the 14th Amendment.
Yes. But as more Haitians were migrating and this kind of anti-immigrant sentiment was growing and growing in recent years, all of a sudden you had different steps that were being taken in the DR to restrict who could become a citizen. You know, for one, government agencies began to just refuse to renew documents or issue documents to people who had some Haitian descent. But the big thing is this court decision.
That in 2013, a brand new constitutional court took up a case from 2008 of a Dominican of Haitian descent named Juliana de Guispierre.
And Juliana de Guispierre had filed a case claiming that the civil registry refused to issue her an ID card because she had dark skin and a French-sounding name. She had complained that this was discriminatory, and so the case made its way to the Constitutional Court the same way a case might make its way to the Supreme Court in the U.S.
And in that case, the Constitutional Court made a ruling that she could not be a Dominican citizen.
Because her parents' paperwork was invalid.
But on the basis of that ruling, they made a much larger conclusion.
Which is essentially that the Dominican-born children, or even grandchildren, of undocumented immigrants should be considered in transit in the DR. Like, they're just passing through on their way somewhere else. And therefore,
that they were not entitled to this constitutional provision of birthright citizenship.
In other words, their citizenship would be revoked. And as part of this court decision, the court ordered a review of the books going all the way back to 1929 to draw up a list of people to now exclude from citizenship.
So this was like a huge decision in a country that has a lot of people who are of Haitian descent. I mean, this was not just going to affect one or two people. This was going to affect hundreds of thousands of people.
Exactly. It's hard to give an exact number, but according to a UN study, 200,000 people or so could potentially be affected in a country of about 10 million people. And so, you know, with the stroke of a pen, the judge basically took all these people who were the children of Haitian immigrants, many of whom had never even been to Haiti, and said, you are now foreigners here.
How was that taken in the country?
Well, it's very interesting. There were different reactions in the country and internationally. The local media mostly, you know, supported the government, but the international media condemned this right away. And because of that, the Dominican president announced this new plan. El
gobierno de República Dominicana promulgó este viernes la ley que reconoce la nacionalidad de los hijos inmigrantes indocumentados.
This new plan, in theory, would restore citizenship to Dominicans of Haitian descent. And it divided them into two groups. Anyone who had their birth in the DR formally registered, they were supposed to just get their citizenship back, no problems. The second group was made up of people whose births in the DR weren't formally registered, people like Antonio. They would get the opportunity to apply to get on a path to citizenship, but first they'd have to sign up with the Dominican government as foreigners, even though they were born in the DR. And for a third group, people who were not born in the DR, aka immigrants, they were ordered to sign up and apply for Dominican residency by this deadline of June 17th, 2015. And if they didn't do that, they could be expulsed from the country. And so tensions really just started to rise.
And there was an expectation that basically when this deadline passed, in which people needed to register themselves, that there was going to be some kind of mass deportation. And there was a tremendous freakout that summer.
Enforcement of a new immigration law begins Wednesday, prompting many to join lines at government offices for registration or face deportation.
There is a government in the world that's denationalizing a people, and there isn't a single international body that's doing something about it.
In the U.S., there was talk of boycotting the Dominican tourism industry.
People all over the world were suddenly fixated on what was about to happen in the Dominican Republic. And I think people were expecting something incredibly dramatic to go down.
The Dominican Republic is set to begin what some are calling ethnic purging, placing the fate of hundreds of thousands of Dominicans of Haitian descent into limbo.
Meanwhile, Antonio Charles, the guitar player we've been talking to, he now had to figure out how he could stay in the country that he was born in. Antonio's dream in life, remember, was to study, especially to get a university education. He can't go to university without documents, but he manages to convince one university administrator to kind of bend the rules and let him be there kind of under the table. According to the government plan, he needs to register as a foreigner, and in theory, this will get him on that path to restoring his citizenship. But like many people, he doesn't want to register. You know, he doesn't trust the government will do what it says it will do, and he says, I was born here. I have the right to stay here. I'm just not going to do that. And so he embarks on this endless journey through the Dominican bureaucracy to try to get documented as a Dominican. He goes from agency to agency.
I was really frustrated.
Try to get some papers that show who he is.
When I went there, they put me in a special book.
He goes to the embassy.
I went to Haitian ambassador.
Eventually, he gets a passport from Haiti, which is a country, remember, that he's never been to. And it does say in the passport that he was born in the Dominican Republic. But the thing is, he doesn't have any of the other papers he needs to prove that, so there's an issue. But still, he was really excited about this.
And when I get my passport, that, wow, I got some document that allow me to be normal.
He's like, yes, I can do something with this. And then he starts to realize that actually this passport is not going to let him work.
So basically he has a passport that is invalid just because it's Haitian and he's in the Dominican Republic.
When I met with Antonio, as you heard earlier, he had this folder full of letters and diplomas and every piece of quasi-documentation that he could ever put together. And he carried it with him at all times, just in case he got grabbed by immigration and sent to Haiti. And he told me, you know, if he got sent to Haiti, it's not just like he could start over really easily.
I took a little bad Creole.
And, you know, he doesn't know what he'd be able to do for work.
Really, my Creole is so bad.
And this whole conversation made me curious.
Do you feel Dominican in a way?
Yeah, I feel I'm Dominican.
He says he does feel Dominican, even if much of society doesn't accept him as Dominican. He says his whole life, people have made him feel like an outsider. You know, every moment, just shut up, Haitian.
So just kind of constant bullying because of the fact that his family was from Haiti.
It's those little things that you grew up with them that make you really feel like, what?
He remembers this one time when he was young at school and he was told that he had to raise the Dominican flag. And some other kids told him he couldn't do it because he didn't have Dominican blood.
Tú tienes que tener sangre dominicana, hijo.
And that's something he's heard over and over again in his life. You don't have Dominican blood. Now, this whole topic is super controversial in the DR. And there are Dominicans really on all sides of this issue. There's a lot of people who oppose the government and many who support it. I talked to somebody who was on one extreme. His name is Pelegrin Castillo. He's the head of a nationalist political party that advocates for deportations and building a wall on the Dominican-Haitian border. He sees Dominicans and Haitians as completely separate people with a separate culture. And he thinks it should stay that way.
Un estado que no sea capaz de definir quiénes son sus nacionales o cuáles son sus políticas de migración.
As he puts it, a state that is not able to define who its citizens are or what its immigration policies are,
deja de ser estado.
Stops being a state.
Lo que hay un problema de indocumentación. El gobierno haitiano tiene años que no documenta sus nacionales en Haití.
In his view, the issue is that Haiti doesn't properly document its own people and that the international community is now pressuring the DR to document Haitians as Dominicans.
A los nacionales haitianos como dominicanos.
All right, so let's get it back to this moment of having to register. And this is in 2015. There was this deadline. So what happened?
Well, there was no big explosion of violence that some people feared. And the issue has mostly stayed out of international headlines since then. But a significant number of people have been sent to Haiti. In the first year after the deadline, around 100,000 people reportedly were returned to Haiti, including people officially removed, you know, and deported or expelled from the country, and those that kind of picked up and decided to leave. And that's both Haitian immigrants and some people of Haitian descent who were born in the DR. Meanwhile, one interesting side effect is that you've developed this whole big activist movement that's come out of these Dominicans of Haitian descent. You know, they're young people who have been getting loud and saying, we're not going to just go quietly. We have the right to be here. It's kind of reminiscent, actually, of what's been happening with Dreamers in the U.S. But Antonio says he's not really into the whole protesting thing. It's just not his personality. He's just trying to focus on himself and pursuing his own dreams and pursuing his music studies. And, you know, he told me that his dream is to one day maybe get a scholarship and get a chance to study outside the DR.
Maybe in the first stage of my dreams, but I know that someday I will get travel.
But the thing that continues to limit him is this idea that exists in his country that he shouldn't be there because he doesn't have Dominican blood, that his country isn't actually his. Because all of his life, people have told him, you know, you don't have Dominican blood. But he asks,
what kind of blood do we have?
What is Dominican blood? You know, what does that even mean? What makes his blood less Dominican than another person's?
Who gets to decide, right?
Yeah, exactly. Who gets to decide? And that's the question, I think, at the heart of this debate, both in the DR and in the U.S. It's actually a philosophical question about what citizenship even means. With birthright citizenship, the thing that confers belonging to a place is just being there, being on the land. You know, you're born there, you're a citizen. And when you take that away, it becomes much more weird and complicated. You know, what is it about? Is it about blood? Is it about race? Is it about language? What is the thing that makes you a citizen? What bothers Antonio the most is that everything that's happened in his life isn't about his actions.
I'm not at all what I really wanted to be just because of who I am.
Not because of what you did, because of who you are.
Yeah. And that really feels frustrating.
And who he is the child of immigrants, not Dominican enough.
Our thanks to Marlon Bishop for that piece, which first aired in March of this year. Last spring, there was a flare-up in anti-Haitian sentiment in the DR. Two Haitians were accused of killing a Dominican couple with machetes in Pedernales, a town near the border. After that, a group of Dominican nationalists, vigilantes, went through that town with a loudspeaker and announced that all Haitians had to leave within 24 hours. Many Haitian families left, fearing for their lives, and Dominican soldiers were dispatched to the border to keep the peace. Since then, things have calmed down a bit. And an update on Antonio's life. He applied for a Dominican visa as a Haitian national, and he was able to get it. So he has legal status, which means that he's officially a foreigner in the country where he was born. Coming up on Latino USA, a conversation with actor Raul Castillo about his upbringing in McAllen, Texas, and how he goes from playing in a punk band to acting. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland and Northeast Ohio more globally competitive, livable, sustainable, and just. More information available at gundfoundation.org. And the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, whose Clinical Scientist Development Awards support promising early career physician scientists and their research efforts to improve human health.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Now, maybe you've seen him on HBO's Looking.
I used to have braces like that when I was little.
Really? Mm-hmm. Let me see your teeth.
No.
Why?
I don't like them. They used to call me El Dientes when I was little.
Or maybe you've seen him on the Netflix show Atypical or 7 Seconds.
As a Puerto Rican officer, are you really telling me that race doesn't matter?
Not in my experience.
Or maybe you've seen him in a film that premiered this year at Sundance, We the Animals.
Listen, do me a favor. I need you to be good and quiet around your ma. There was an emergency.
She hurt?
Wherever you've seen him, right now, it seems, actor Raul Castillo is everywhere. But he's been acting and writing for over a decade and even produced an off-Broadway play. I sat down with Castillo, the son of two Mexican immigrants, to talk about how he went from playing in a punk band in McAllen, Texas, to landing acting roles left and right. So recently, as you've told people, I'm from McAllen, and they say, oh, you mean where they're actively separating kids from
That's
their
right.
parents?
Yeah.
What's that like?
aggravating. I love where I come from. I'm quite fond of my home community, and I think I see real beauty in the kind of tight-knit community that it is. And for it to have that kind of profile now really is upsetting. Yeah. And then before that, conversely, in Reynosa, I think God had made a name for itself for, you know, narco violence, which wasn't something that was a thing. And I was going, I'm not saying that drugs weren't being transported or there wasn't human trafficking in that part of the world. But when I was a kid, this will give you an idea of how much it's changed. When I was a kid, to sort of write a passage for teenagers, high school kids, was to cross the border and go to the clubs in Mexico. Everyone would talk about that. You know, oh, you're going to Mexico this weekend, going to Mex. Yeah, you know, go to the clubs and dance and whatever. And we were kids, but you could do that then. I'd get spotted by an uncle and they would rat me out to my dad. And my dad, you know, and we'd get in trouble, you know, because you weren't supposed to be doing that.
When you were hanging out in Mexico on the Mexican side of the border as a kid in high school, and you're Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
So what was that like for you? You know, because you hear a lot about white kids going to mm-hmm. Tijuana or to Mexico.
Sure.
But you're a Mexican kid growing up on the U.S. side of the border, and you're going to hang out in Reynosa. ¿Cómo era eso? Like, what was it? What was that like?
It's complicated because especially at that time, the border was more porous and it more fluid, and it felt... Yes, you were crossing the border, but it's right there. It's not like it's Reynosa. It's like where I grew up. It's like, you know, it's where, I mean, I grew up going back and forth every weekend of my life. I had the same barber from my first haircut to the time I was like 15 in Reynosa. You know, we go shopping there. Like there's that quality where it just feels like being home in a sense. And then there's the other quality, which is there's the way that Americans go to Mexico and the third world in general and sort of dump on it. It's just the place where they can do the dark things that they won't do at home. And it's interesting to observe that and to be Mexican and American and to be home in Mexico and to see that play out. I remember it sort of weighing on me. I left pretty young. I was 17. I turned 18 in Boston when I left as an undergrad.
You obviously started young if you were already at BU at 17 studying theater. Where was that born? Was it in Reynosa or was it in McAllen?
Probably in McAllen. Before I got into theater, I have an older brother and a younger sister, and I sort of wanted to do everything my brother did. And my brother started playing guitar very young. I wanted to do that, but I knew I wasn't going to be as good as him, so I was like, I'm going to pick up the bass. Because he would sit there and study music for hours. He would play scales, and he's a real musician, and he's a really gifted musician. I would go into my room and lock myself and put on a tape and, you know, imagine being at the school dance, what girls were going to be there. And I would start the song. I was sort of lip syncing or air guitaring on my bass. And
I love this.
Yeah. And I would start and, you know, sometimes my mom would come in with laundry. Hi, mama. You know, I was so embarrassed. She would catch me in the middle. And if I lost concentration, I would stop the tape. I would go back to the beginning and I'd start again. That's acting. I was transferring to public school in ninth grade. I had to pick an elective, and they wouldn't let me do orchestra. I was already playing in punk rock bands. I was playing shows.
Wait, at 13 and 14?
Yeah.
Wait, but last we heard, you were airplane on your bass. So you actually did learn how to play a bass.
Yeah, I did play. And I formed bands with my friends.
So you were good at it.
Yeah. I'm a damn good bass player. I'm a mediocre musician.
Okay.
I'll put it that way.
Okay.
I'm a really great rock bass player. So when I go to transferring to public school, I want to get in the orchestra, play cello. That's my goal as my elective. But they wouldn't let me because I hadn't been doing it for the 3 years in junior high in public school. Like, you know, I didn't have that training. So I had to pick another elective. And the year before, there was a production of Pippin at McAllen High School. And this guy, Eddie Martinez, who played in another band that we played, he was a singer, played Pippin. And all the girls in my junior high went to go see Pippin. They were all glowing and going on about Eddie Martinez, who played Pippin. And I was like, all right, girls, like, you know, they're like actors. I should get on stage. So when I was looking for an elective to do, I went to theater. And I just thought it'd be another way to get on stage and act like an idiot and get some attention, and you know, and
it didn't mean jumping into a mosh pit.
Exactly.
A little safer.
It's a little safer. I have some scars. I kid you not, in my head. Yeah.
Oh, I bet. Yeah. That's why I'm so thankful my kids were never into punk rock. So there you are at 16, 17, punk rocker, you know, but then you apply to school in Boston?
My sophomore year of high school, I transferred to McAllen High School. And there, on one of my first days, I met my now dear friend, Tanya Saracho, who's the showrunner of Vida.
Wait, in the hallway?
Yeah, in the hallway. She was passing out flyers for people to audition for the play. So Tanya and I became friends. We started dating when we were kids. And
I didn't know there was a dating.
Yeah.
Just so everybody understands, Tanya Saracho is like a big deal right now. I mean, she's an incredible playwright who is now the showrunner of Vida.
On Stars.
On Stars Network, which has been renewed for a second season. But you guys were high school sweethearts in McAllen, Texas.
Yeah. And when I met Tanya, I was in remedial English.
In high school.
In high school, because I was lazy and undisciplined. I thought of myself as not academically adept. Not that I wasn't bright, because every kid has their potential, but I just hadn't found it. And teachers were, quite frankly, letting me slip through the system. And so I was just being lazy and taking the easiest classes I could take. And Tanya, of all people, was the one that was like, what are you doing? You're not going to get into college like this, taking these classes. You got to take college preparatory classes. You got to take honors classes. You got to take government. You got to do this and that. And I was like, okay. And I listened to her. And so I started taking those classes. But it was Tanya. It was like Tanya who did it. And then I got to BU. And to be honest, like even at BU, I sort of was slipping through the cracks in a lot of ways my freshman year. I was trying to get through the system, kind of having a tough time of it, being a brown kid in New England. I didn't experience the United States the way these other people did, and they made me aware of that.
And how would they make you aware of
where
that?
Where are you from? Texas. No, but where are you from? I'd never heard that in my entire life. Salem with a straight face was born and raised in Texas. And then you'd have the uncomfortable conversation that would lead to you finally answering to them the question that they really are asking is, what kind of brown are you? That's really what people are kind of asking. They want to kind of compartmentalize you. I tell that story because it's analogous of the whole experience.
So you probably thought that there was going to be a long distance between you and McAllen and actually making it as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, it's not just you. I mean, we've brought up Tanya Saracho a lot, but you know people who you were either in high school with or in college who are powerful people now. They're showrunners, they're writers, and you're getting a chance to work alongside them. I imagine that just must be like so incredibly dreamy. Like you're working with people who you worked with in high school doing theater, but now you're doing it like for the whole country.
Yeah. Yeah, I was on the Vida set the other day. I already shot my first two episodes and we were, it was so trippy. Like, you know, I was on Tanya's set. It was a really nutty thing. And it was a new feeling. Felt natural. It felt right. It felt like we'd been doing it for a lot of years together. And it felt like the most natural thing, but it almost felt like at some point someone was going to pull the wool out from under us because, you know.
And say, just kidding.
Yeah.
You Latinos actually can't get this show. Just kidding.
But I'm so stoked to be on that show. It's such a great group of characters, and I think it'll be fun.
You know, in this country right now, we're going through a strange, and that's using a light term, to be Latino or Latina, certainly to be Latino, Latina, Mexican from the border. It's a challenging time for all of us. But at the same time, there's this other story, which is that there is a real power shift in some places, like in the world of the arts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you're getting a chance to experience that. Your career is only going to grow from here.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, there's kind of like, we don't like you. And on the other hand, like in your personal career, it's actually like, well, things are going pretty well.
Yeah. My girlfriend's from Portugal. And she grew up over there in the States as well. But we've been trying to get there for a number of years. And finally, this summer, we were able to. So we went out, we were on the beach. And it was right when all this stuff was happening with all the kids being detained and families being separated. I felt so guilty. And it was one other time I'd ever felt that feeling, and a similar kind of feeling. And I don't know quite what it is, but I was a senior at BU, and we had done the senior trip to New York. The entire theater class comes to New York. We see a Broadway play, and we met with like established alumni, like Broadway producers and actors and this kind of thing. And I was like 21 years old, still a baby in a lot of ways. And this group of mostly actors and a couple of writers like myself, and we were going to all these luncheons and things like that. And like, I remember one night we were at this bar after seeing a play, and in this bar in New York, in New York City. I was like a kid from McAllen, Texas, and here I am. And everyone was acting like it was the most natural thing. And hobnobbing and trying to network. And I went into the bathroom and I cried. Because I felt this guilt that I was experiencing something that my parents didn't get to experience. And why? Right? Why do I get to do this? And they don't. But I try not to get disillusioned, and I try to just to focus on the little power that I do have and try to use it as best I can.
Thank you, Raul.
Thank you, Maria.
Catch Raul Castillo in We the Animals. It's available streaming on demand or in his new role on season 2 of Vida on Stars. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Miguel Macias, Antonia Cerejido, Maggie Freeling, Janice Yamoka, Sayer Quevedo, and Maya Cueva, with help from Fernanda Chavarri. We're edited by Marlon Bishop and Sofia Paliza-Ca. Our engineer is Stephanie LeBeau. Additional engineering this week by Rebecca Weinman. Our production manager is Natalia Fidelholz. Our fellow is Jesse Alejandro Cottrell. Our interns are Paula Mora and Comis Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. And if you like the music you heard on this episode, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. And I'll see you there. Hasta la próxima. Ciao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by Winecoat Foundation and the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
And you're like, no, ma, no me interrumpas. Voy a ir a tocar en mi conjunto.
Yeah.
Like, what group? And then you're like, no, mi conjunto punk. Is that what you were saying to your mom?
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. This is NPR.